Right. We were starting, so for our visitors, we're actually in the middle of a study of Acts and the epistles that have been arranged in chronological fashion. So we're shoving the epistles into our study of Acts as well when they were written. And so we've just finished Acts 15, we finished Galatians, and we're now looking at James because those are both written both before and after the conference in Jerusalem, respectively. And we're now in James chapter 3, verses 13 through 18. We're starting with that section this morning. And so, just recap, who wrote James? James, right? What was, bonus points, what was the name his mother gave him? It's not James. By the way, I still haven't researched how we actually got James from his actual name. But his name, even if you pop open a Greek New Testament, you'll see his actual name. You won't see James. James just somehow ended up in English translations of the Bible. Whereas his name, does anybody remember? Well, Joseph and Mary tended to name all of their children after Israelite patriarchal heroes. So you have Judah. Judas is just a Hellenized form of Judah. Judah. Then you have Joseph, which I think is in the King James translation. I think the ESV renders that name as actually Joseph. So he's, you know, Joe Jr., named after the patriarch, the son of Jacob. And then you have Jesus, who is actually, what's the actual name? Anybody remember it in Aramaic? Yeah, Yeshua. Yeah, Yeshua. And the Aramaic name is a shortened form of the Hebrew name Yehoshua, which is the actual name Joshua. So Jesus, like, we get that from Greek into German into English, but in Hebrew he's actually named after Joshua. So in Hebrew it's Yehoshua. And the last brother is named Jacob. So if you open a Greek New Testament, you'll find Yaakovos, right, which is the Greek way of writing that name, Jacob. So the brother of Jesus, member of the church in Jerusalem, who ends up becoming one of the leaders, one of the elders there. So again, he writes it just after the Jerusalem conference, as best as we can tell. And we're looking at the last few verses of chapter 3, which actually sort of form the pinnacle of the entire book. That a lot of the book, as far as, you know, what James is talking about in this letter, builds up to these verses here. And the rest of the book will build down from them. So what we have here is sort of the zenith of the epistle. This is sort of the heart of what James is really talking about in this whole letter that he's writing to the Jewish Christians in the diaspora and the scattering. And so here we are. And just to sort of put ourselves in mind, he's sort of opened up with chapter 1, talking about, way back in the beginning, you know, what does stress actually do for us in our spiritual lives? And if we approach it the right way, it can strengthen us and help make us better. And with that in mind, in order for us to be able to respond to the stress of trials and tribulations responsibly, we have to actually do what God tells us to do, thus hearers and doers of the word only. And he ends that section with, you know, if you want to know how to make God happy, what do you do? So what do? Obey, right? But pure and undefiled religion before God the Father is this: visit orphans and widows in their affliction. Why orphans and widows? They can't pay you back. They can't give, whatever you give to them, they can't give that back to you. This is actually sacrifice. In the cultural and the economic sort of situation of the first century Greco-Roman society, there's no social security. I mean, there's nothing, you know, like the social safety nets that we have now. So orphans and widows are left without people to provide for them. They have nobody, they have nothing. So if you give to orphans and widows, you're never going to get that back. They can't repay you. They can't do you any favors. They cannot return. So it's about the nature of sacrifice. And it reminds us a lot of David's statement in 2 Samuel 24. When he buys the threshing floor of Araunah, he says, Araunah tries to give it to him for free. And he says back to Araunah, no, I will buy it for you for a price. And what does he follow that up with? Yeah, I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God that cost me nothing. Right? I'm not going to give to God something that was free to me. And it's about the nature of sacrifice. So the first thing James says is visit orphans and widows in their affliction. What's the second thing he says? Keep yourself unspotted from the world. Live morally and ethically pure, as well as living a life of giving and sacrifice and generosity. And so then he goes into partiality. So when you do these things, make sure that you do them the way God does them, without paying attention to what's on the outside of a person and treating everybody equally. Because if all you do to the people who don't have much is if you say, go your way, be warm, be filled, but you don't do anything to actually accomplish that, then you've actually just done nothing. And that's faith and works, right? That's the next section of chapter 2. And he says, and by the way, while we're talking about how we treat people, let's talk about how we talk about people. And that's sort of the taming of the tongue passage. And that's the first section of James chapter 3. So all of this builds up to these verses and everything after it builds down. So he says, and we've often likened James before. If we're going to liken James to any book in the Old Testament, which book is it like? Actually, we went over this in the introduction, so I hope we remember. If you weren't here for the introduction, that's okay. You have an excuse. Yeah, actually, you know, James may very well be the only New Testament book that qualifies as wisdom literature. Because he deals with the concept of wisdom a whole heaping lot, doesn't he? And as a matter of fact, this section starts with a question, who is wise and understanding among you? So James deals with wisdom a whole lot. It qualifies, I would say it probably qualifies as a book of wisdom literature in the New Testament. But as it's not in verse, as it is in prose, which one of the Old Testament wisdom literature books is it the most like? Ecclesiastes. Because it's in the introduction to the book and the printed material and the booklets that we all have, huh? James has a lot in common with Ecclesiastes. Because, you know, the collector, or Solomon, whoever, doesn't matter. What he does is he approaches life from different perspectives. And James actually sort of just throws that, well, he does approach life and he contrasts what Solomon contrasts in Ecclesiastes, life under the sun versus life under God. And we see these two played off against each other, and nowhere are they more clearly played off against each other in the entire epistle of James than in this section. Because he's dealing with wisdom. And in Ecclesiastes, Solomon deals with under the sun wisdom, and where does under the sun wisdom lead us to? In Ecclesiastes. Where does it lead us to? How does he start the book off? Vanity, it's all useless. It's useless. Because life without God, the only philosophical result of that is nihilism. Because without God, nothing matters. It's all useless. And you might as well just party and live it up and just be totally crazy. But you know, with God, there's a whole lot more to life than just what we see under the sun. And sort of he closes Ecclesiastes with that perspective. So remember that your Creator in the days of your youth. There were some people here earlier this morning before class started who were talking about what it's like to get old. And in Ecclesiastes chapter 12, that's exactly what Solomon does. Before the grinders cease, before those who look through the windows grow dim, before, you know, the daughters of song are brought low, the almond tree blossoms, referring to white hair, and the grasshopper lies heavy. You know, all those poetic illustrations that he gives of us of what happens when those years come upon us. But then he says, you know, this is the end of the matter. All has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, right? So James sort of deals with that contrast of only he phrases it, he sort of couches it in different phrasing. So instead of under the sun, what does he describe? How does he describe what Solomon describes as wisdom that's under the sun? James says that's wisdom from what? From below. As opposed to the wisdom from above. Now, by the way, this whole from below, from above, where does that terminology come from? Because from above is obviously from where? From God. From below is from where? From Satan. It's from the devil. So where else do we find these concepts sort of juxtaposed against each other, from above versus from below, with it, especially in the context of from God or from the devil? Anyone? I can wait. There's no, well, I was going to say there's no wrong answers, but that's not correct. If your reference doesn't include anything as a contrast or as from above or from below, then that's wrong. But there are a plethora of answers that are, because this is not something that should be foreign to us, is it? So what are some other texts where people can't use from above versus from below? Galatians. Where? Okay, all right, that's actually, it doesn't mention specifically the words from above or from below, but that fits. Because, you know, the Apostle Paul uses this phrase, walking by the Spirit or led by the Spirit, to talk about things that are based on the wisdom from above, a life that is led by God as opposed to led by our appetites. Led by the pretty, the pleasurable, and the prestigious. And so, Galatians chapter 5, verses 16 through 24, I believe is the reference you're going with. The works of the flesh versus the fruit of the Spirit. That fits. Good catch, Pat. Anyone else? I'm waiting. I can wait. I believe there was a man who once said, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth. Who was that guy, by the way? That's right, it was Jesus. Don't lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal, but instead lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroy, where thieves do not break in and steal, for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Right? Where else? Other similar passages. Yeah, there's a lot of the Sermon on the Mount, James, isn't there? What about Paul in Colossians? Set your mind on things above, not on things in the earth. What have we just finished studying on Wednesday nights? What's that, Pat? I was going to say, I know you can talk louder than that. I'm just stealing Judy's line, aren't I? It's a good line. I know you can talk louder than that. So what is it? We just finished a study of Revelation on Wednesday nights. I mean, is there any more book where from above being from God and from below being of the devil are more clearly illustrated for us? Where does Zion come from? Where does Jerusalem come from in Revelation? It descends from above. Right? What about the beasts and Babylon? Where do they come from? They rise up. They rise up from below. That one beast comes from the earth, one beast rises up from the sea. So, both of them you know, again, we have this juxtaposition of above and below there in the imagery. So, by the way, where does God's presence, when God's presence fills the temple, where does it always come from? God comes down to the temple. Even to Mount Sinai, he came down to Mount Sinai. Right? So there's this consistent imagery of above versus below. So he says, who is wise and understanding among you? What does he say after that? By his good conduct, let him show his works in the meekness of wisdom. By the way, that's sort of an interesting phrase. The meekness of wisdom. I want to double check one thing real quick before I actually say something. Okay. Oh, yeah, okay. So I was right. Yeah. Okay, so this is sort of an interesting phrase. He says, let him show his conduct, or let him by his good works show his conduct in the meekness of wisdom. There's something interesting going on here grammatically. And it's how the word wisdom is written in Greek. And I'm not going to get technical. I'm not going to do that. But I'm going to say something about it to let us sort of shed light on what's going on here linguistically. The way the word wisdom is written in Greek is an extremely flexible way of writing a word. Basically, you can take a noun in Greek, and if you write it in the correct way, you can turn that noun into an adverb, which is how the word gift is written in Romans chapter 3, when he says, do not be deceived, for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God and are justified by his grace. The New American Standard says freely. The ESV says as a gift. But what's happening in Greek is you're taking the word gift, writing it in a way that turns it into an adverb, even though it's still a noun. You can take a noun in Greek and turn it into anything, almost. And the way they're writing this noun in Greek right now is that it creates one of the ways of rendering it, and one of the ways I think is a bit more contextually appropriate as far as interpretation of James 3 is, you write it as what's called an appositive. Does anybody remember grammar and what an appositive is? Nope. Okay. All right. So an appositive is a phrase in English where what we do is we write something and then we write a comma and then we write a phrase that explains what that thing is and then another comma and then we continue the sentence. That's what an appositive is. So one of the ways that you could render this faithfully, according to the way it's written in Greek, is let him show his good works in meekness, comma, which is wisdom. And that's really what we're talking about, right? Because if we're going to summarize, I mean, that, by the way, is sort of the perfect encapsulation of everything that James follows through with after this. Because the equivalence of meekness and wisdom together are sort of the whole point of this text. Putting meekness and wisdom and saying they're the same thing is, so let's go ahead and we'll see that as we get into it. So he starts off much like Paul in Galatians 5 describing the works of the flesh versus the fruit of the spirit. James starts off with wisdom from below here. So he starts off and he says, if you have what in your hearts? Bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not what? Do not boast and be false to the truth. By the way, boasting and being false to the truth are equated here. The way it's written is they're the same thing. Boasting and lying are the same thing. So we'll get into all this in just a little bit. It says, this is not the wisdom that comes down from above, but is, how does he describe? He uses three words to describe it. What is it? Earthly. Unspiritual. What translation are you reading from? What's that? Oh, the Revised Standard? Oh, okay. The Revised Standard says devilish. Demonic is the way the ESV translates it. It's a strong word either way. So he says it's earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. We'll talk about those in a bit, right? For where jealousy and selfish ambition, going back to if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, for where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, what follows? Disorder and every vile practice. Okay? Every vile practice. So, by the way, so far this wisdom from below, bitter jealousy, selfish ambition, boasting, lying, is that in any way, are those behaviors in any way meek? No, they're not. But the thing is, when it comes to the world, would the world tell us to live by this wisdom? Some people, yeah. Because ultimately, I mean, if we go back to the descriptions that this world, this kind of wisdom is given, it sort of sheds light. He says it's earthly. It's of this world. A perfect way to describe it would be under the sun. The way Solomon uses that phrase in Ecclesiastes. The way Paul uses the word fleshly. It's earthly. Another thing that he says, so what's the second descriptor that he gives it? Earthly. What else? Unspiritual. This one's kind of a fun word. It's a fun word for sort of an ironic way, for an ironic reason. It's the word that we get psychic from, by the way, psychikos. It's pretty much just psychic in Greek. But when we hear the word psychic in English, what do we typically tend to think? When you hear the word psychic, what pops into your brain? Deception. All right, great one. Hucksters, right? But I mean, psychic. What is it? What kind of stuff, what kind of abilities are they claiming? They can tell things that are going to happen in the future, right? Or they can read minds. Yeah, or tell the meaning of something that's hidden, right? The whole extrasensory perception thing, the ESP, right? Okay, the funniest thing about this is that psychic in Greek means the exact opposite. What psychikos means in Greek is somewhat... By the way, does anyone have any other translations of this word psychic or unspiritual? Anyone have King James, right? Natural, right? Oh, New American Standard, okay. The King James also translates it that way. Natural. So the King James and New American Standard both say natural. And what it is it's... That really is sort of the best equivalent for under the sun. Someone whose life is governed only by what they can see, feel, touch, taste, smell, and hear. That's the natural man. And you'll find this word psychikos translated natural consistently throughout three times in 1 Corinthians 15. It's used here in James. And it's used once in Jude. And in Jude, the King James renders it sensual. Or the King James also renders it sensual here. But it's translated as natural in 1 Corinthians 15. But in every case, what it means is someone who's governed only by what their physical senses can tell them. By the way, is that a lot of people here in our society today? Yeah, it is. There's a lot of people who walk around, including a lot of people that I went to school with. Because I was, I was a science major. There's a lot of people in that field who, like, if I can't measure it, it's not real. Okay, well, there's a lot of things that we can't measure that we know are real. But that idea sort of goes out the window when we sort of examine it with, I don't know, common sense. But that's what this word psychic in Greek actually means, is someone who's governed and limited by their physical existence. Someone who lives only within the boundaries of what their physical senses tell them. And so when James says that these traits are psychic traits, he's saying that these are just poor, short-sighted people who live only according to, you know, it's like there's nothing beyond this life. When you die, and that's it. That's ultimately what the psychic person believes. When you die, and that's it. Psychic as in biblical Greek terminology, not modern English. We are large predatory mammals, right? We're large, we're mammals, we're predators. That's what we are. We eat other things that were once living. At least, I don't know, I do. I know some people don't, but you guys have seen me inhale burgers. What this is all about, by the way, he follows it up with a third word, demonic or devilish. Demonic's probably a little closer, but six and one, half a dozen the other. And of course, he doesn't mean this literally, but he's saying, look, it comes from the devil. Right? This is what the devil wants you to do. What ultimately we're dealing with here is people who are led by their large predatory mammal instincts. And our large predatory mammal instincts tell us to abuse other people for the sake of our own elevation. Do we see that often in society? Anyone? Yeah, okay, well, let's give the... Where do we see it? Where does it manifest itself? Okay, everywhere. All right, that's a good start, Phyllis, but let's get specific. How do we see it happen? Nobody can think of any examples of... Too many? Okay, just pick one and we'll start. And then perhaps the floodgates will open. Politics. Okay, all right, politics. Yeah. You know, higher education, especially higher education. But you know, let's deal with them in order. Politics. Political parties are like the death of honest governance. Because what happens is elections become about staying in power instead of truth and what's good for the people. You know, you guys have heard me say it before, whether it's the donkey or the elephant, in the end it's just another golden calf. That's the way the world works. But you have people who are willing to lie, cheat, steal, deal in alternative facts or whatever you want to call it in order to maintain political power, to keep the reins of power in their hands. You know, you look at history, and it seems like our democracy looks like the Senate near the end of the Roman Republic. It's insane. And it happens. It happens. And you know, by the way, also this whole predatory mammal instinct. You guys, who here watches the news? At all. gluttons for punishment. We've got some of them, right? But, you know, one of the favorite, like, tactics that the news that just all over, it doesn't matter who, which particular, all the outlets do this now, whether it's national, liberal, conservative, whether it's local news, okay, their favorite tactic for getting you to watch the news is, you want to know what you've got to be afraid of next? Right? How many times have you seen sort of a teaser for what's, by the way, commercial breaks are the death of honest news. Because when news becomes about ratings, they're no longer about the truth. But that's just sort of my curmudgeon-y rage going on. But before the commercial break happens, oh, we're going to show you something that you need to be afraid of. So you need to stay tuned and sit through the commercials and wait for us to come back so you know what you need to be afraid of next. Fear. And we could deal with politics all day long. And we could pick on individual people. We could pick on... It just get us all angry and mad at everybody else, and that's not really constructive. But higher education, right? Especially higher education. That's absolutely true. This definitely happens in higher education. Large predatory mammal instincts, you know, the desire to exert control over other people. And that's ultimately what we're talking about, is our desire to control other people, to elevate ourselves by demeaning others and placing them under our control. That happens in higher education a lot. There's a great documentary about the whole concept of intelligent design and how it's totally unacceptable in a lot of higher education fields that Ben Stein did, called Expelled. Give it a watch sometime. It's absolutely fascinating. Higher education. Any other examples? Anyone? I think Mom's thinking of one that I'm thinking of. John. Does it happen in the church? Yeah. What's that? Yeah, well, there's that. There's the issues James talked about, giving the best seats to the wealthy, putting the poor in the back. And when we were covering those, we talked about how, you know, trying to target people for the gospel is all kinds of wrong, no matter what standard we use. But, I mean, you guys, I've been open about my past and the kind of congregations I grew up in. And there was one where we were at when I was young, where the preacher there basically bullied his way into the eldership. And then when he became an elder, he tried to get everybody in the congregation to sign this piece of paperwork that says, you can never sue me for anything that I do or say while I'm an elder or a preacher here. By the way, when a preacher forces his way into the eldership, that's generally not a good sign. But when you've got someone who tries to make the congregation sign paperwork that says, you can never sue me for X, Y, or Z, that's also generally not a good sign. And, you know, this guy would say from the pulpit things like, you guys are nothing without me. You owe your salvation to me. You would never know Jesus if it wasn't for me. From the pulpit, he would say that kind of stuff. Okay, is that bitter jealousy and selfish ambition? Yeah. And then it turns out, he's having affairs with women in the congregation. Yeah. Yeah, so some people certainly knew about that. It happens in the church. This was a man that was governed solely by his large predatory mammal instincts. Now, he was intelligent. And he knew a lot. But he wasn't wise. Because he wasn't meek. Because all these things that are described as the wisdom from below are things that are the opposite of what meek means. Humble. Gentle. Right? And let's just go into what James says the wisdom from above is now, in contrast. That's the wisdom from below, right? So, now he says the wisdom from above is what? First, it's pure. Which means it's not diluted by any kind of fleshly desire. If it's from above, if it's from heaven, it seeks only heaven's goals. It seeks only heaven's desires. It's pure. And then it's what? What is it? Peaceable. It's peaceable. You know, we mentioned politics earlier. I think it was Florence mentioned politics earlier. Politics. Are there many political figures these days that are trying to unify us? To seek peace between different parts of the electorate? Don't seem like it to me. It's pure. It's peaceable. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called what? Sons of God. Peace. So it's first pure, then peaceable. What's number three? Gentle. Oh, there's one. Are we very gentle in our country today? Anybody been on Facebook or Twitter recently? Because there's nothing really gentle about those spaces. Just sort of as a commentary on digital communication and the way it happens in our society today, the internet has sort of developed. This is sort of just a colloquial set of phenomena that people have observed. They're not. They call it the rules of the internet. They're not actual rules. They're just sort of, oh yeah, by the way, this stuff happens on the internet, right? This is just sort of a description of what the internet has become. And some of them are comical. Some of them are kind of. But some of them are kind of interesting social commentaries on what we as human beings, by the way, if you want to look for a perfect distillation of the wisdom from below, look at how people communicate in the comments section. One of the rules of the internet is never read the comments. Because the way people respond to comments like on YouTube videos or what have you, there's absolute Reddit posts or, you know, horrible. Or Facebook, you know, whatever it is. But one of the rules of the internet is called Godwin's Law. And what Godwin's Law states is that the longer any conversation goes on, the closer the probability becomes to one, meaning the more certain it is, that someone in the conversation will call somebody else a Nazi or Hitler. And if you've ever had any sort of online communication at all over like an extended sort of comment thread on a Facebook post or on anything else that you've seen, yeah, it's pretty much true. But, you know, in our society, we have gotten so used to the seeming anonymity that the internet gives us, or we feel that the internet isolates us from consequences. Because, you know, people will say stuff online that they would never say face to face because they know they get punched in the face. But they say this kind of stuff online because they feel like they're immune from consequence. Because they can type out the most horrific, abusive, just downright nasty things about someone else, hit the enter key, and then nothing happens. Whereas if you said it face to face, you might be bleeding. But we have gotten so used to being abusive online that that has spilled out into our face-to-face conversations. And we have become a people that are the opposite of gentle. We're harsh. We're caustic. We are acidic. Just nasty. And it's not gentle at all. pure, peaceable, gentle. What else? What's number four? Open to reason. Wow, there's a revolutionary concept. Admitting that you might be able to be wrong, that you might be wrong about something, or that you made a mistake. No, we never make mistakes, do we? We're always right. Don't correct me. I mean, if that just doesn't describe who we've become as a people, I don't know what does. And I'll refrain from comments about individual things that are popping into my mind right now, but, you know, as the case may be. What does he follow that up with? Full of mercy and good fruits. But do we like mercy in our country? Does our society love mercy? Do we? No, we like revenge. We like making people pay, don't we? Nothing gets ratings and gets people talking in society like seeing a great person fall. And that person's reputation becomes stained forever by what they do. Now, in the cases of a lot of things that have been happening recently, I want to just preface this with, if a person... By the way, if crimes have been committed, people should be prosecuted because we as a nation need to love justice. That is important. God praises societies that love justice, that do not pervert justice, that execute justice honestly both on the rich and on the poor. By the way, one of the things he says in Deuteronomy chapter 10 is, you know, when Moses says for God to the Israelites about, you know, not perverting justice, not favoring the rich at the expense of the poor, he actually immediately follows that up with nor favoring the poor at the expense of the rich. So both of those things need to be done. And there are some things that have come out in society that rich people, rich and powerful people, have gotten away with for a long time because they were rich and powerful. And I truly do think they should be prosecuted as far as crime is concerned, and that justice should follow. I do believe that. But there are other instances where someone has just said something on Twitter that's not criminal. It might be foolish, it might be ill-advised, and it might be derogatory to a certain person or a certain group of people. Or it might be a joke that's just in very poor taste. Now, imagine, if you will, there's a film director that has made a particular studio massive amounts of money because he's made incredibly popular films that have done really, really well in the box office and critically. And then some tweets of his from like 10, 12, 14, 14 years ago have popped up. And they've been brought to light. And his response is, yeah, I wrote those. I was young. I was foolish. I was trying to get attention however I could. And, you know, I'm not going to erase them because they're a part of my past. And they're a part of my past that I'm not proud of, but they're a part of my past. I'm sorry I did them. I shouldn't have done them. And everything I've worked for since has been to sort of erase that, or to sort of to show that I'm different now, that I've changed, and to encourage other people to change. Because, you know, I shouldn't have said those. Those were in really poor taste. And they were some jokes that were in very poor taste. So, what should happen to that guy? Should we move on? Okay. What if that guy gets fired from his next project for that same studio? For something that happened 14 years ago that he's apologized for, that he's actually told people, you know, it was wrong, it's bad, don't do it. And that he's not trying to pretend like it never happened. By the way, one of the things celebrities do when tweets of theirs in the past come forward that, like, they're embarrassed about now is they try and erase them from Twitter. They try and pretend like they never happened. This guy, just imagine this guy doesn't do that. And he's like, no, it happened. I'm sorry. It was bad. I shouldn't have done it. That, by the way, was James Gunn, an actual guy in the entertainment industry. We love to see people torn down. As a society, we love to see them torn down and just ripped apart in front of our eyes. Because we're not merciful. That we've become a society that is led by our large predatory mammal instincts. And that's not acceptable to God. It never has been, and it never will be. We should be gentle. We should be peaceful. We should be pure, peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits. That's who we as Christians should be. Because Christians have always been, in some way, shape, or form, counterculture figures. There has always been something about the culture of our day that has been in contrast to the Word of God. Because the culture of our day is cultivated from below, not from above. There is always something about our civilization that is going to be wrong, and there is always something in our civilization that we need to stand against as God's people. That has always been true, and it always will be true. Because we are always the people of God, not the people of the world. We're led by the wisdom from above, not by the wisdom from below. We have an obligation to be godly people in a sinful, broken, and dark world. We need to be forgiving. We need to be gentle. We need to be open to reason. We need to be peaceable. We need to be pure. How does he end this section? What's the last verse in chapter 3? A harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. By the way, I don't know if there's sort of a more perfect thing to describe who we ought to be than this. Historically, by the way, historically, churches of Christ, have they argued much? Let's be honest. Have they argued much? Brethren like to argue? Yeah, what do we like to argue about? I'm looking at Charles and I can tell he wants to say something. Yeah, everything, man. One cup, multiple cups. Next, we're going to start arguing whether multiple cups should be plastic or glass, right? Whether you have to cook the bread for the communion at home or whether you can buy it from a store. Marriage, divorce, remarriage. Some of the issues that we discuss, that we get vigorous over, are serious and important things. Right? Don't get me wrong. Some of them are very serious, important things where we have to take a stand and say, no further than here. Because that's beyond the bounds of what's acceptable to God. But my goodness, do we like to argue over nonsense, don't we? It's just totally ridiculous. And I get, by the way, I saw a debate. Sort of, it was friendly, and they were both kind of joking about it. But this happened with a couple of my friends on Facebook, and they were both kind of joking about it. So I want everybody to know that, first off. But I saw sort of a joke argument. And they were actually poking fun of the fact that we argue over anything and everything by having this argument. Because I know both of these guys, and I know they were joking around. that, you know, well, is it grape juice or is it wine? Which one is it? And so they were going through their joking debate, and I couldn't resist saying, well, if we want to go back to the way it actually happened in the first century. By the way, this is one of the arguments that people like to use a lot in these arguments about nothing. You know, we have to go back to the way they did it originally. And whenever the topic of communion comes up, and I'm like, well, and then about you people say, oh, should we use one cup? Or we should, if we want to go back to the way they did it originally, we should all have clay bowls. We should fill them with about one part wine and about four parts water. And then we should have some pita or some naan or something like that, a flatbread like that. If we really want to go back to the way they did in the first century. We argue over nonsense. But we also get heated over things, don't we? Over things that have nothing to do with the Word of God and with His kingdom. Because sometimes we equate the right political stance with Christianity and with are you faithful or not. Because I know that happens. And I know that happens because I've seen it with my own eyes. And we get trapped in worldly pursuits and worldly endeavors. And we forget what's really important. By the way, what's our annual theme this year? Being a good soldier of Jesus, right? From 2 Timothy chapter 2. And one of the lessons that we've already had was a soldier doesn't get involved in what? Civilian pursuits. A good soldier doesn't involve himself in civilian pursuits. What that means is, why are we getting heated and arguing over stuff that has nothing to do with the kingdom of God? Now, if it stand on morality, on what's right and what's wrong and how we define that, that's worth discussing. Because we have to expose, you know, the unfruitful works of darkness, right? That's an obligation that we have as Christians. But if it doesn't have anything to do with that, why are we getting so upset about stuff that happens? And we get caustic with each other, and our large predatory mammal instincts come out. But a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. By the way, does this remind us of any previous, this is going to lay the foundation for another verse in James. Actually, no, it was a previous verse, my bad. James chapter 1, verse 20. What does that one say? Anyone? James 1, verse 20. The anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. When we get heated over stuff that doesn't really matter in the long run, it doesn't do us any good at all. All it does is create problems for God and for us. And it's all a bunch of nonsense in the end. So, I'm going to start the next section for just a couple of minutes. We'll lead into it. We'll dig into it next week. But I want to give us the lead in now so that we can understand what goes on. And so what I said is all the stuff in James builds up to this and the rest of it builds down from it. Those verses sort of form the pinnacle of the book. And we see this because in chapter 4, his shift starts to go into, why are you arguing? And he obviously knows that they're arguing, that it's sort of this big problem that they have. Surprise, brethren argue. But why does he say the arguments happen? in chapter 4, verse 1. What's that, Jesse? Because your passions are at war within you. What does that mean? What does it mean to have passions at war within us? The things you want. Yeah, the things you want, the things you desire. But why would they be at war? What's that, Kennedy? Okay, so, Pat, were you going to say something? Let's go back to what Pat referenced earlier, Galatians 5. The works of the flesh versus the fruit of the Spirit. Those who walk by the Spirit have done what to the flesh? Have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. For the desires, walk by the Spirit, not by the flesh. For the desires of the Spirit are against the desires of the flesh. Or the desires of the flesh are against the Spirit. That what James is talking about, our passions being at war within us, is what he's talking about at the end of the first section of chapter 3. With the same tongue, we do what? We bless God, but we curse the man who's made in God's image. That when he talks about our passions being at war within us, what he's talking about is the fact that we are a people who are divided, not just amongst each other, but we're divided. I am divided with myself. Because I am not pure-hearted. Because sometimes I serve God and sometimes I serve the devil. And I say it that way because when I serve myself, I really serve the devil. That I don't want what God wants all the time. And when we allow this bitter jealousy and selfish ambition to rear its head, as Kennedy was saying, we become divided internally amongst our individual selves. And that means we become divided amongst each other as a group as well. And that's what happens. And so that's what the next section is all about. So we'll leave there this morning and we'll pick up with James chapter 4 next week. So thank you everybody once again for your comments, for your participation. And our Bible class this morning is dismissed.